Good evening, everybody. This is Jeff J. Brown, China Rising Radio, Sinoland. And I've got a great guest on the show tonight, Lawrence Freeman. How are you doing, Lawrence?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
I want to thank Matt Arrett for putting Lawrence and me in touch. And I don't even know if Lawrence knows this, but I lived and worked in Africa for 10 years. And so when he told me that Lawrence was an experienced expert on Africa, I thought I got to talk to this guy because I think I've visited like, I don't know, 23 or 24 countries in Africa, but that was a long time ago. That was back in the 80s. So I'm really happy to have Lawrence on and talk to a soulmate who loves African people and African culture and like I do. I miss it a lot. Let me tell you a little bit about Lawrence before we get started. Lawrence Freeman is a political economic analyst for Africa. He's been involved in economic development policies for Africa for over 30 years. He is a teacher, writer, public speaker, and consultant on Africa. He is also the creator of his blog, which I will give the website link to. Mr. Freeman's stated personal mission is to eliminate poverty and hunger in Africa by applying the scientific economic principles of Alexander Hamilton. I also have his Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn links. And so thank you for being on the show tonight, Lawrence.
My pleasure to be with you.
What are the scientific economic principles of Alexander Hamilton? The last time I thought about Alexander Hamilton was when I took was high school when we studied American history before 1865. So what are the scientific economic principles of Alexander Hamilton?
Well, that's good. I didn't learn much about Hamilton at all in school. Hamilton, unfortunately, my American friends know very little, and the rest of the world almost knows nothing. He was an economic genius who actually was an immigrant from the Caribbean. And he designed, under the direction of President George Washington, Hamilton was the first Treasury Secretary, a set of economic policies that steered this country to become the greatest industrial power, and still can if they're followed. The conditions of the United States were very similar to Africa. At the end of the war, we had about $72 million in state, local, federal debt. And the 13 colonies were completely isolated from each other with different scripts of credit and paper. And Hamilton designed a policy to unite all 13 colonies together, establish a national bank, which he would absorb the outstanding debt and reissue new debt at lower interest rates that would become the capital for the first national bank, which was also supported directly by the federal government with a $10 million loan and nominating some of the board members of the new bank. And he, thank goodness, succeeded, with eventually backed by George Washington, in defeating Jefferson and the physiocrats and the slavocracy, who insisted that agriculture was the only source of wealth. And Hamilton said no. He said, we need a manufacturing capability that will increase the value of agriculture and will make us truly sovereign, so we won't be importing our products from Europe, especially from England. Mm-hmm. The founding of our United States and these principles of credit, manufacturing, were Hamilton's gems that he's passed on to us and were copied around the world. They had nothing to do with Adam Smith. We did not develop by the free market. And he established a school of thought, Hamilton, that became known after he died in the 1800s under people like Henry Carey and Friedrich List as the American system of political economy, in direct opposition to Adam Smith's free trade. My view is that we could use a credit bank, and I'm working with a group of Africans here in the U.S., African Infrastructure Development Bank, which would take in a capital base and lend money out at low interest rates for infrastructure projects in Africa. I am convinced that if we had the infrastructure in roads, energy, and rail, there is absolutely no reason we couldn't eliminate poverty and hunger. As you know from traveling around Africa, there is no problem with agriculture. Africa [S2] No. [S1] Is almost self-sufficient in the 70s and has now been made food dependent. We spend $35 billion in Africa importing food, which is entire waste. So I know these Hamiltonian credit policies will work if we can get them implemented.
Very, very interesting. And so are there any countries in Africa who are expressly applying Hamiltonian economics? And does China apply them with their projects in Africa?
Well, China, yes, is an interesting case. I haven't traced out exactly all the connections, but clearly either China on its own, which is highly unlikely, or through various connections, their Belt and Road policy emulates in many ways the American system of political economy of Hamilton. Some of these loans are 15-year loans at 2-3% interest rates with grace periods. And this is the kind of loan you need for infrastructure. Infrastructure, you're not meant to make a double-digit profits every hour the way the traders do in Wall Street and the City of London. They're a long-term profitable investment in the future of your economy, because you're lending money for the future, and that future returns a profitability of the entire economy. I don't come across too many people in Africa, if any, who understand this principle, but some African countries have applied it, maybe not knowing it. One is Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. They have been practicing a policy of directed credit, capital credit into key infrastructure projects. They did this with the Djibouti to Addis Ababa railroad line in 2016, which I was on the maiden voyage. And now they've done it with the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, where they raised between $4.5 and $5 billion internally through bonds and contributions from in the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, which could produce the largest injection of energy into the continent. So they're applying the principle, even though they may not identify it as scientifically as I do.
Yeah, so you kind of froze there. So what you were saying then is that they got this $4 to $5 billion of credit, and they actually issued national bonds that were bought internally.
No, they raised the money internally by selling bonds to their own people. The money was raised only from Ethiopians. There were no loans from any banks.
Yeah, well, the West doesn't like that. They want IMF to get in there and make impossible to repay loans, so they can seize public assets and natural resources.
Right. And if you look at which is a clear indication to me, I mean, I look for signs and indications of policy that are very clear in what they mean. The United States, under President Trump, nor under President Biden, neither of the presidents, have actually ever complimented, praised, or supported the Ethiopian government on creating the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, which is with 6,000 plus megawatts, will be larger than most countries have. And this gives you a sign of the problems of the West. They don't believe in development. And even when something is done by Africans, they won't support it.
Yeah, well, they don't like development because there's no double or triple digit profits. And investment is, 20, 30, 30, 40 years and, very low single digit return on investment. And that's why all these crazy pipe dreams of, Trump and Biden, trying to get 50%, private investment in private investment in infrastructure in the United States will never work, because it has to be public. It has to be government driven, like in China, because there's not enough money in it for them to be bothered with it. So I got a chance to take a look at your website, and right now you have a big headline: COP27 just held their big gap. You know, I'm now, but you have a thing about COP27. And so they just held their big Gab Fest in Egypt, and you take a jaundiced view of its usefulness in Africa. Are African countries volunteering to jump on the bandwagon? Are they being bribed, blackmailed, and extorted by the West to do so, the typical imperial method of foreign relations? Or are they getting away with merely paying lip service and ignoring it?
Well, the COP27 began last Sunday and will go through this week. And I mean, it's on one level, it's a complete fraud and hypocrisy, because all the Western governments, including our own, all the Western financial institutions, and this crazy mixed up Senator Kerry, have been insisting that they will not lend money for any African nations to invest in any energy production that involves fossil fuels. Now, of course, the irony is, and it's more than an irony, the West right now is scrambling, is actually traveling to the capitals of African nations to get their hands on oil, on gas, and coal because of the cutback of energy from Russia. Now, the African energy situation across the continent, I mainly focus on sub-Saharan Africa, which is the majority of about 47 nations below the desert of the Sahara Desert. There's less than 100,000 megawatts for over a billion people, which is criminal. This has to change. You cannot have a modern industrialized economy, a Hamiltonian manufacturing economy, without energy. The Africans know this. And what they're going to do at this conference is they're going to not challenge the fundamental tenets of what the West is saying. They're not going to say, we're not going to do it. They're going to say, well, we may do it, but you have to give us enough money to do it. Now, the West, the money started being offered back in 2009. And then I think in Glasgow last year, they pledged $100 billion to help African countries make the transition to renewables, which, of course, the energy minister of South Africa, Montashe, said, well, if renewables are so good, why don't you guys use them? But in any case, there's no money. They never raised $100 billion. Now they're talking about raising $1 trillion by 2030. That'll never happen. I hear Biden the other day pledged $250 million, which is somewhere between a farce and a cynical joke, because you can't build anything with $250 million. So the Africans are going to mildly object, request the money. The West won't deliver the money, continue to pressure them, and the Africans are going to go ahead among themselves and with friendly allies, and they have to produce their own energy, otherwise their people will die. So the whole conference will actually accomplish nothing.
Yeah, it's like Kabuki theater. it's just going to be all form and no substance. Well, that's good news.
Blaming the Africans for the quote increase in CO2, which is causing climate change, and one is, I'm not convinced that CO2 is the cause of climate change as I've studied, and two, the African contribution is about 1/1000th of a percent of CO2 to the world. So it's a farce. Now think about what is the intent? And the intent, I believe, is a Malthusian population reduction.
Absolutely.
They don't like the fact that Africa is the fastest growing continent of quote black people in the world.
Absolutely.
And they would like to see the population come down, as well as the world population come down.
Absolutely. 1698, Robert Malthus and the Western elites, the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, the Schiffs. I mean, all the oil banking families. They have all been just incredible eugenicists, you know, from the early 1800s on. So I totally agree with you. A number, you know, I do because I did travel and work in Africa for 10 years, and I do probably more than most Americans or even Westerners. I do follow it quite a bit, and I noticed that there are a number of countries that are showing strong interest in working with Russia. I'm seeing especially Mali, the Central African Republic, and South Africa. We can even throw in Nigeria. I remember I just saw an article maybe about 10 days ago where Lavrov, I think, was talking, the Sergei Lavrov, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, was talking about Nigeria. What does Russia have that appeals to Africans, and how is it similar or different than China's presence?
Well, as you probably know, and your viewers know, the concept of the, quote, international rules-based order, end of quote, this no longer exists. I mean, the Chinese are now the most dynamic economy in the world, and they will be the largest economy in the world before the end of this decade. Russia, by their actions in Ukraine, whatever you think of them, nevertheless, have broken any control by the so-called Western rules-based order. Now, in Africa, China has played an indispensable role over the last 20, it really took off around 2000. And the last 20 years, about $140 billion has been invested primarily in infrastructure, manufacturing, construction. This dwarfs the entire rest of the world combined. It's dwarfed by what China's investment, especially in infrastructure and manufacturing. If you were to remove China, as many thoughtful Africans know, as opposed to the West, if you took China out of the picture, there's no other entity, no other institution, no other nation that would make up for that credit. So they've played a very interesting role for over a generation. Russia has not played the same economic role, but they have played a supportive role on the UN Security Council and also in military affairs. Other countries that are involved is India is investing. Turkey built the first leg of the Tanzanian Railroad. India is involved. And Russia is involved because it's able to support some of the countries in West Africa militarily. Now, I'm not saying they're doing it in the best way, but some of the African countries just got sick and tired of being run by the French, and the French weren't accomplishing anything. And I just read the other day, the French have virtually pulled out of their 5,000-man force they had in the Sahel. The Sahel is a disaster, and it wasn't caused by the Russian military. It's caused by President Obama and Hillary Clinton and Samantha Powers, who insisted on overthrowing and killing, assassinating Gaddafi in October 2011. That has the Sahel has been suffering in hell for 11 years since that. So the Russians give some military support. I think there are discussions to build a naval base in Sudan. So far, they've not been a major big player on the economic front. Japan has now had two Japan-China-African conferences in the last several years. They're not nowhere near as big as China, but they're playing a role. So there's a whole mix of countries. And I think what the African leaders are going to realize is they're going to get together among themselves and with allies and push ahead with these development policies, especially energy. And maybe the West, I hope my country, the United States, will come through its senses, maybe not. Maybe we'll encircle it and force it to be thoughtful. And I think the BRICS becomes another opportunity for a parallel institution to the IMF World Bank, but one based on a paradigm of development. So there are all these things out there, and the West is very upset about losing its power. I mean, Anthony Blinken, Secretary of State for the U.S., was sent there in August. He visited South Africa, Rwanda, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And he got diplomatically pushed back pretty hard because he just kept saying, we're going to bring you democracy, 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 international rules-based order, human rights. And, you know, they pushed back. And the Prime Minister of South Africa, very intelligent woman, Pandor, she said, well, we don't like being bullied. And yeah, South Africa, since you brought it up, I just had a conference with Russia and China. So South Africa is establishing itself as a potential focal point for trade with the two other big superpowers that are breaking apart the rules-based order.
I think now that you reminded, you talked about Russia and energy. I'm pretty sure I saw an article maybe about a month ago that Algeria may have signed a deal with Russia to build a nuclear power plant.
No, I'm not sure that's Algeria. I know there is ongoing construction of several power plants in Egypt by Russia, Rostov.
Okay, because Russia is really, really good at it with nuclear power.
Right. Exactly.
Some of the best in the world. And the Africa needs megawatts and an easy concentrated way to do it without cutting down forests and everything else is to.
Now you brought up a good.
So point. Yeah, and also Egypt.
The Russians are very. You're correct. The Russians provide very good input on nuclear energy. There's only two energy plants, nuclear energy plants on the continent in South Africa, built by the Afrikaners. But there's 16 or 17 nations, which is almost a third, are in some discussion about feasibility studies, applications, the Atomic Energy Committee. I mean, Ghana, Nigeria, Kenya, Ethiopia. Yeah. But right now, the South Africans, I don't know if they've picked China or Russia to build possibly 9,600 megawatts of nuclear power. And the Egyptians are building two or more nuclear power plants with the Russians in Dab, Egypt. So you're correct. This is a very important contribution.
I think Russia will get a number of those contracts if the rest will probably go to China. So
and some maybe a few to India.
Yeah, well, let's get to France. You know, I'm dual national, American and French, and so I know I follow France and Africa. It's a horrible, horrible story. But anyway. My next question is, French West Africa is still colonized by the post-war currency called the CFA.
Yes.
Whose overvalue keeps French imports cheap and the African countries' exports pricey. France's central bank controls these African countries' sovereign wealth funds.
Yep.
And when they withdraw their own money for national projects or investments, they have to pay interest to France. It's just criminal. It is the worst kind of neocolonialism. Is there any way for these CFA countries to break free from this French financial hammerlock?
There's 14, I believe, 14 countries, not just West Africa, but the majority in West Africa. There's 14 countries that are called Francophone and using some aspect of the C for the CFA. And there's a rebellion brewing. I think Senegal leadership and some others have said, we don't really need the CFA, the CFA anymore. It's interesting, if you look at West Africa or French-speaking Africa and English-speaking Africa, the British were very overt in their control of the eastern spine of Africa. And they use various things like ethnicity and dual mandates to maintain their divide and conquer. The French were actually more insidious because they incorporated the French colonies right into the French economy and the French culture. I'll give you an example. I was in Mali and I was in Cote d'Ivoire in 2020 as an observer in the elections of President Ouattara. And you sit in one of the fancier hotels, and on the big screen of the TV is all the French media. And we're talking among ourselves with the French, Ivorians, and we say, well, why don't they have the local news from Cote d'Ivoire or West Africa? So one of the guys was so upset, he went up to the head of the restaurant and said, could you please switch to a local news station? But the French have insidiously inserted themselves into the actual culture of the West Africa. So this is a big issue. Got a lot of attention here a couple of years ago when the ambassador to the African Union from the U.S., my friend, she went on a crusade against the French and their control of West Africa, Chiombre Kwa. And this caused a big stir. So it's brewing, but we're not yet at the stage of actually getting rid of the French. And I think Macron is very nervous about being the president who loses West Africa. But he's offered nothing really of substance to these countries.
Yeah, well, he's alienated the Algerian president, and he's upset almost everybody he's met from West Africa. He is feckless. Macron is absolutely feckless. I have been to Ethiopia. Probably not many Americans have, but I have been to Ethiopia. Of course, this was back in the 80s. The times were very, very different back then, But how much influence does the West have in fomenting the regional conflict in Ethiopia with Tigray? Some analysts say it is being used by the West to punish Ethiopia for having too much cooperation with China for infrastructure and economic development. Your comments, please.
Well, Tigray, I mean, Ethiopia is a very complex and beautiful culture. And of course, it stands out among all of Africa because in 1896, March 1st, they defeated the Italian army on the battlefield in Adwa. And they don't celebrate independence like we in the United States think, because they were never colonized. They celebrate Adwa Day. And this was a tremendous unifying force of national identity under Menelik II. Now, what happened was when the coalition opposing the Derg regime, which controlled Ethiopia during the time you were there, from 1974 to 1991, under Meriam Magisku, they set up ethnic regionalism. It didn't exist before. They set up control. So their federal constitution, which I've criticized, the 1994 constitution, establishes ethnicity as a political regional control throughout the country. So different regions are controlled by different ethnic groups. I hate ethnicity. I saw it in Nigeria and I was appalled by it. Mm-hmm. And it's other places. So the ethnicity is a killer because it defines you biologically or geographically from what piece of dirt you came from, rather than being a human being with the powers of creativity and creative imagination. This government under Abiy Ahmed, which came in 2018, they began to overturn it and set up the Prosperity Party, a non-ethnic party. And this caused all hell to break loose. And what happened is that the West, and particularly the United States, which had a very comfortable relationship with the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, which ruled the country from 1991 to 2018, they were forced to realize that they were losing, they no longer had the TPLF, and that this guy Abiy Ahmed may not be under their control. And immediately went and signed a peace agreement with Eritrea, who they fought a war with a generation ago, and established friendly relations with Somalia. So look at geopolitics. Geopolitical doctrine is a zero-sum game. Either you're on top or you're on bottom. If you're up one, someone else is minus one. Look at the Gulf of Aden, the Indian Ocean, the Red Sea to the Suez Canal, major trade, transportation, commerce route. They, the geopolitical fanatics, were not going to allow this special prized area of Africa to be controlled by Africans. So Abiy was targeted. And I was the first to make this observation when the TPLF attacked the federal government and called for overthrowing the government. I was the first to make the observation that the West is planning regime change. That they no longer had control through the TPLF, and this guy Abiy was out of their control, the first option they were going for was regime change. And as a result, I became somewhat of a folk hero among the diaspora here in the U.S. and in the, at the Ethiopians. And I was doing battle directly with the U.S. government, because in November, the State Department went nuts. And they started saying, Americans have to leave Addis now. The TPLF is at your doorstep. There's hysteria in the streets. Come to the embassy. If you can't buy a ticket, we'll give you money for a ticket. We don't want another Kabul like Afghanistan. So I said, this is nonsense. And I talked to some of my Ethiopian friends. So in November, after Thanksgiving, I flew to Addis. And the minute I arrived there and tweeted out, the conditions were not hysterical. The bars were open. Food was being served. Very active nightlife in Addis. I was bombarded by requests for media. So for 12 days in Ethiopia, every single day I was interviewed, and every single day I said, this is disinformation from the embassy of the United States. And this was all done because they didn't want to lose control. Now, this peace agreement signed on November 2nd was done under the auspices of the African Union, the former Nigerian president, Obasanjo, the former Kenyan president, Kenyatta. Now, Mike Hammer, our special envoy, was there as, quote, a participant. And we don't know what was said, but I believe he was there to try to fight for not allowing the TPLF to have some legitimacy in Ethiopia. But the agreement established the fact that the government is in control, that the TPLF will not have a military force, will not run Tigray, will not control Mekelle, and that there is the Ethiopian territory, the integrity of the Ethiopian territory will remain as Ethiopian. This was a very positive development. It's not finished yet. I've been screaming for development. We have to get shovels in the ground to reconstruct northern Ethiopia. But it was very promising, and I don't think the West liked it, and I don't think they've yet given up that they've lost control.
They won't give up. They won't give up. They've got lizard brains. They're reptiles. they can't think beyond control, conquest. Anyway, good luck for Ethiopia. I love that country when I visited there, and went two or three times, in fact. And
good for you.
And that was back during Mengistu's time.
Did you make it up north?
No, I went south. I went south into the Rift Valley, and it's just beautiful. And the people are beautiful and wonderful. Well, let's move on to a neighboring country. Some think that, like Hambantota port in Sri Lanka, the Mombasa port in Kenya has secretly signed away its ownership over to China, which helped develop the project. Objective analysis in Sri Lanka shows that this is not true. What about Kenya and Mombasa, where I spent a lot of time in Kenya and have been to Mombasa a number of times? So yeah, tell us about that project.
Well, this was this is part of the whole concept around the Belt and Road, because what should be done is, it should have been years ago, east-west, north-south railroads crisscrossing Africa. And there is a plan to do that. Unfortunately, the African Union targeted 2063, which is a little too far off. But there should have been a bunch of north-south, east-west railroads, which are in the plan. And there's a plan for high-speed rail network as well. And this would give you like a checkerboard of transportation of rail, which would touch every major city and port. The obvious thing you do is you start on the East Coast and you go west. And this is what China has worked on with some of these African nations. Now, if you look at Kenya, which you know, of course, the first non-Africans to visit Kenya were not Europeans. They were the Chinese under Admiral Xi in 1420.
Absolutely.
And so it's well known. So they started building what was called the Standard Gauge Railroad. The nickname is SGR. From the port, Mombasa, and is to go west and go through Nairobi, continue to go west, connect up with Kampala And also, and then Kigali. So you'd have a connection between Uganda, Rwanda, Kenya, and then that becomes the basis for continuing west to become an east-west railroad. And the port of Mombasa, which is overcrowded, they're building another port now, is key to this. And same thing in further up. If you take the port of Djibouti now, the railroad that connects to Addis Ababa, that also can become a connection point for a westward drive across the continent. And these contracts, and of course there's a lot of fuss about them because they're used, they're trying to be used as a propaganda weapon. But the Chinese don't own anything. And what they do is they work out, many of the agreements are all different, but they work out an agreement. They lent the money for the first phase of the standard gauge railway, which goes from the port of Mombasa to Nairobi. The second phase, not yet. And that was a loan, and it has payback terms on it, which are always flexible. The claim that is made that somehow China is purposely indebting these nations so that they lose control of the project or their assets has totally false. There's not one single project, not one single African country that's been taken over by China. Yeah. And you don't have to take my word or your word. You could go to the John Hopkins China Africa Research Institute, CARI, run by a woman named Deborah Bottengaum.
Yeah, she's wonderful.
And she has they have the largest database
of she's incredible.
China in the world, from China to Africa.
Yeah,
she said this five times. She said, there is no takeover. There is no takeover. There is no debt trap diplomacy. But it doesn't stop the stupid Congress, the stupid administration, Republican and Democrat. They all repeat this nonsense as if it was true, and it has no truth in it.
much of your website under the, because you have different headings, and of course I studied the Chinese one the most because that's where I've lived and worked for 16 years, and am very interested in how China works around the world, I just, I recently saw, and maybe it was Deborah, what is her name? Deborah Bottengaum?
Bottengaum.
I think it was her website where they had a graph of the total foreign debt in Nigeria, and China only has 10%. All the rest of it's, Western, international, and Asian institutions. I mean, it's just like Japan, South Korea, IMF, Western banks. China only has 10%, and yet China is doing most of the infrastructure and development cooperation in Nigeria compared to the West and all the other countries. It's just 10%.
Well,
it's crazy.
That may be the case in Nigeria. Across the continent, their best figures are a maximum of 17% of the debt of African nations goes to China. So it's now over 30% is the international financial institutions, the Paris Club, the IMF, and the World Bank, over 30%. And then maybe the largest sector is 35%, which are international investors and bondholders.
Yeah.
So the maximum amount is 17%. In many countries, it's lower. A few countries, it's higher. So the claim that the debt crisis in African nations is because of excessive Chinese debt is beyond propaganda. It's an out-and-out lie. And it's good that CARI, which is based at John Hopkins University in Washington, is there to tell the truth. But even though they tell the truth, and Deborah's a fine speaker and a good writer, they still go up and you'll see Biden or Blinken or any people, Trump did it, they all do, they start babbling about Chinese debt destroying Africa. And they have no concern that none of it is true.
Yeah, unbelievable. I have an Afrikaans, and for those of you who don't know, there are two large language, at least for foreigners, not counting the African languages, but in South Africa, there are the English, the Anglophones, and there are the Afrikaners who came from the original Dutch. And so I have a lot of friends in South Africa, and one of my favorite countries in the whole world. I hope I get to go back. I traveled all over that country. It's just amazing.
Nice.
But anyway, I have an Afrikaner friend who visited. This is a true story. Who visited Nelson Mandela twice a week in prison to offer conversation.
Wow.
And Mandela liked and respected my friend. The feeling was mutual, and this went on for a couple of years before Mandela was released. My friend said Mandela was a committed communist and wanted South Africa to have its Cuban-style socialist revolution, but finally decided on the, you know, what I call the, quote, Indian independence route, where the local 1% elites took over from the British, keeping things pretty much as they were, while providing a patina of revolutionary reforms. Like India, South Africans continue to have one of the world's highest Gini index scores, G-I-N-I index scores, showing tremendous concentration of national wealth in just a few hands. India and South Africa are both members of BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Do you think that this body and or China's BRI are helping redistribute some of South Africa's immense wealth to the 99%? Or like in the West, is it getting worse and worse?
South Africa has a serious problem. What your friend and you were describing about the situation in South Africa under Mandela was that Mandela was option B. Because what happened was an option A under the Afrikaners, the country was becoming ungovernable. So they had to move somewhere else. There was a meeting, it's described in one of the histories of South Africa, 1987, up in England, where about 30, 40 of the wealthiest financial institutions, George Soros was there. And they said, look, we can't operate this way any longer. And they reached out to form some kind of arrangement looking for Afrikaners who would be able to move Mandela out of the prison and establish some kind of black democratic rule. And Mandela, and I have no knowledge of him personally in this, but what appeared to happen was they accepted a political revolution, which is that black Africans would vote and majority-controlled country. But they did not change the economic policy.
Yeah,
so you have a large section, not just of the wealthy black Africans you're talking about, but you still have a large percentage of the mineral wealth is still controlled by the City of London, the commodities cartels, yeah. Anglo-American, Royal Dutch Shell, Rio Tinto Zinc, Oppenheimer. So the Africans did set up this plan to enriched black Africans, and now but a special super wealthy class was formed. And there's the greatest disparity between poor and wealthy Africans, not black Africans, in South Africa of any country on the continent.
Yeah.
And this is very serious. And that's why you get breakaway groups like this, the Young God Millennium and so forth, screaming about this disparity. And the wealth under the ground is still controlled by the City of London, a large portion of it.
So this is
a powder cake. Plus, they have a terrible energy situation. It's dropped a lot of progressive programs. However, they do have some interesting people in the government who understand some of the best policies for moving forward, such as Mantashe, who's the energy minister. I'm very impressed with him. I put his picture a couple of times on my website. And the equivalent of their foreign minister, Pandora, Natalie Pandora, they're very smart and they're very articulate. And even though there's a lot of criticism of the current president, Ramaphosa, there is indications that they would like to move forward with a better policy for development. But if they don't, like Nigeria, which I know very, very well from 30 years of being in and out of there, the poverty of the population is the Achilles heel. You've got, I don't know when you were there in South Africa, but right now you've got very high unemployment, 25% unofficial. You've got slums. You've got ghettos. You've got people living with no running water. In Nigeria, you have 90 million people out of 220 living under $2 a day. These situations, if they're not reversed, could lead to the overthrow of the government. And they've got to address this, which is why I keep saying we have to have a Hamiltonian development perspective for Africa.
It's I have South African friends, and I know of course when I was there it was apartheid, and it, you know, you could just feel the seething hatred. And I was working in agriculture, and so I visited a lot of farms, all the owners were white and all the workers were black, and they called him Bosman, you know, Boss. But I mean, I just remember one time, you know, there were, you know, the owner's, you know, right hand man, you know, was trying to have a meeting with the workers, and one of the workers, you know, plunged a pitchfork into his foot, and so you can just feel, you can just see this can't last forever. Nice. this is not gonna work. And of course these people were just so polite and so gracious and also so very, very racist. It's just unbelievable. Yeah. Totally convinced of their racial superiority. And so I don't know why, you know, Mandela, maybe he just realized maybe the futility of trying to have a Cuban style revolution, but in a situation like South Africa with all the racial groups, the Zulus and the Indibelis and, you know, and all the others, maybe it might have been a better option. But of course the United States would have done what it did to Mozambique and Angola, and when they tried to have their socialist revolutions, you know, they poured, you know, money into opposing groups and gave them arms, you know, to fight the socialists into more or less of a standoff as it is today, I think, in those two countries. But anyway, it's an amazing part of the world, and a lot of people don't realize this, but Africa is a big place. It is three times the size of the continental United States. I remember flying like from Abidjan to Nairobi, and it took forever. It's just unreal. It's a huge. Or flying from, from Harare to Nairobi or something. It just takes forever to fly across that continent. It's so big. Anyway, it's three times the size of the continental United States, has as many citizens as China, 1.4 billion now. And again, as you say, it's growing, and that really upsets the Western eugenicists. It's incredibly diverse. It's got Arabs and blacks and Muslims, Christians and animists. It's got deserts, jungles, vast mountain ranges, thousands of river valleys and lakes, not to mention two oceans and two seas. Any closing comments about Africa's near, mid, and long-term prospects, Lawrence?
Well, it was a good segue you gave me. Actually, Africa, the continent, is actually 3.5 times the size of the U.S. continent, not counting Alaska and Hawaii.
Okay.
Sahara Desert is almost the same size as the United States, 3 million square miles. So just to give people an idea, there's a famous map, you can get it on the internet, which shows you can put China, Europe, Asia, and the United States inside of Africa. Now, no map, global map, shows you this because Africa is so large. But that's and everything you said is true. Now, the population projections for Africa are 2.4 billion people by 2050. That's only 28 years from now. 2.4 billion people. Nigeria, which is the first country I started visiting, there's projected to have over 400 million people during that period. It will be the third largest country behind China and India.
And
they will be bigger than the United States because us Westerners here in the United States don't like procreating, but the Africans do. Now, they will have approximately, they define youth as 35 and under. So by 2050, approximately 1 billion youth. They will have the largest workforce. I'm talking about collectively for the continent. Now, if we don't smarten up here in the West and start thinking again, like Franklin Roosevelt and Lincoln and other great leaders, we are going to create a mess because Africa will be the center of politics and commerce in this century that we're all living in. You can't avoid it. With 2.5 billion people, it's going to happen. The question is, are we smart enough to develop and fight for policies that would lead to the development of this continent? If we do not, then what people see on the TV of poverty, Boko Haram, AQIM, etc., guerrilla warfare groups, this will be nothing. Because if a billion people don't see a future, don't see a way that they can raise their families, that they can have a dignified, productive life, they're going to rebel. And this is, people should wise up. Both now China and other countries do understand this. The West is understanding it only from a negative standpoint of trying to compete with China and Russia. But Africa will be the center of our planet. And if we don't start thinking 20 years ahead about policy, of putting these young people to work now, cleaning up the economy now, getting a manufacturing industrialized sector now, we could be in for a very serious situation. Now, with a billion young people, that's a billion human beings with a billion potentially creative ideas and contributions. So I say Africa is the center of the planet for good or for ill, and that is up to us to determine it's for good. And that's what I'm trying to do with the rest of my life. I'm a senior now. I've been at this for 30 years, and I'm going to continue to fight for this kind of change in policy until I can't fight anymore.
Well, that's admirable. I think that China is playing its part. I think Russia will also play its part. And I think other non-imperial countries like Venezuela and Iran and Vietnam maybe potentially. But if the West wants to keep, if the West, you know, still wants to live like it's 1492, and still wants to, you know, behave like they've got, you know, reptile brains as far as Putin calls the United States, Japan, and South Korea, the West, Japan, and South Korea, the Golden Billion, and all of those other people in Africa and Asia and Central and South America, they're 85% of the world's people. And as you said, you know, Africa is going to have a huge chunk of that non, you know, golden billion, basically the Western world and its vassals. And if we don't, if the West, you know, wants to continue to try to dominate and control and extract and occupy, it's just not going to work. And to be honest with you, after 500 years of colonialism and seeing how France treats the West Africa, which is basically like they're still colonies, that's the attitude of the French, and the Americans still, you know, treat Latin America like it's their colonies, you know, the Monroe Doctrine. I think that Africa is going to have to depend on wise, compassionate leadership, you know, leaders like in China, and I think Russia is also multipolar. Iran is multipolar. and some of these other countries that, you know, can think beyond the next quarterly report.
What's that?
So I'm sure you will be there to help all of your African friends and comrades to make it a better place continuing to make it a better place for the 21st century. So, Lawrence, thank you so much. It's been wonderful having you on, and maybe in another year we can come back and do an update and see what's going on. What do you think?
Very good. I look forward to it. Thanks for the conversation. From a fellow Africanist.
All right. Thank you, Lawrence. Bye-bye. Yes. I will send you this the link and everything, and if you want to put it on your website, you're welcome to.
I will do that.
All right. Talk to you later.
Okay. Adios.
Bye-bye.